Anthony Stalter yesterday in the turn on 101 ESPN, and that's one thing that the Cardinals, since the departure of Chris Correa, have kind of missed out on. And I wrote about this last week, not this past Sunday, but the week before, at 101ESPN.com. I do think that the Cardinals' evaluation process is flawed for some reason. And part of it might be the brain drain that they've suffered over the years. When you have people like Jeff Luhnow and Sigma Dahl and Mike Elias and Dan Kantrovich, you've had a lot of good people, and that's just a sampling of the good people that have left the organization. Clearly, when you have people that are that good, that are getting general manager and assistant general manager jobs in Major League Baseball, you are not going to have the sort of evaluation that you had previously. And that's one thing that the Cardinals need to do a better job of, is evaluating A, what they have in-house, and B, what they're getting.
I would say more so what they have in-house. I think that that's a big one when you look at recently some of the talent that has left, and I'm not even looking at what's come in, just what has left. My thing is with the evaluation of talent overall is I feel like it's a very level playing field right now. Advantages that maybe the Cardinals had before because they did a little extra stuff as far as prep goes, or had some sort of an algorithm that helped them out. Everybody has those things right now. And you look at a team, you heard Anthony Stalter there mention the Yankees. Well, there were 31 teams that passed on Aaron Judge before he was taken. Everybody had a chance to get Aaron Judge. Nobody knew exactly what he was going to be. It is a bit of a crapshoot when it comes to talent evaluation. And the Cardinals have done a very good job over the years of evaluating pitching. And we've seen it year in, year out. There's always somebody that comes up and ends up being the guy. And I don't know if it carries you every single year, but that guy is always there. Now, position players has been different. It's been something. You got a couple on the way that we saw over the weekend in the Futures game, in Dylan Carlson and Nolan Gorman, which people are excited about, and rightfully so. But they haven't had that impact, really, position player over the last couple of years. And Matt Carpenter has been one, and Colton Wong. But the guy, those guys are hard to come by.
And I do believe there's a little bit of fortune or misfortune that comes into play here. And sometimes you go on a streak and you're just really lucky when you're turning out good players, good position players. And for a while, the Cardinals did that. And a lot of times what they would do is produce players that weren't supposed to be anything and then somehow contributed. And you've got the rest of the league looking at you going, who is this guy? And how is he suddenly a huge contributor for you? And that's something they were very good at for a long time. There's probably a lot of good fortune in that. I don't know if it's just, I think we like to look at front offices, we like to look at amateur scouting and development and say there's some secret to it, there's some trick, and these guys just have it figured out. It is such an inexact science. I think if I have an issue with what the Cardinals are doing, it's not really that. It might be supplementing the talent once they get to the big level and really trying to bolster the major league roster. I think that's more my issue with them than what they've done amateur-wise.
And I want to be fair here. The Yankees did draft Aaron Judge in the first round in 2013. Since 2009, he's the only Yankee first-round pick to make it to the major leagues. So when you look at the way the Cardinals have drafted in the first round in that time, in terms of the quantity, certainly they haven't drafted a superstar like Aaron Judge. But when you look at the quantity of players that they've drafted in that time, then I think that you have to say that they've done pretty well.
There are very few guys that you just know, yeah, this guy's going to be a big leaguer and he's going to be great. You don't, because if you did, you would, they'd go as the number one pick every single time. And it doesn't happen that way. Especially in baseball, is such an inexact science. I do think some teams are better at it than others, but I also believe there's a lot of fortune that goes into it. Sometimes it's just dumb luck. You know, go back to Albert, okay? If you really thought Albert Pujols was going to be that, if anybody did, he doesn't make it 12 rounds before he gets drafted. He's number one overall immediately. There's just a lot of
Same
silly
thing
luck that goes into
with
it.
With Trout, I want to make this point, too. When I talk about brain drain, and it was awful what Chris Correa did, but I hate to use the word tragic, but from an organizational standpoint, it kind of was. The one draft that Chris Correa had in 2015, Cardinals took Nick Plummer with their first first-rounder, Jake Woodford with their second first-rounder. Then they took Bryce Denton, In the third round, they took Harrison Bader. In the third round, they took Jordan Hicks. In the fourth round, they took Paul DeJong. In the fifth round, they took Ryan Helsley. And there are a couple of more that are going to make the major leagues at some point from that one singular Chris Correa draft.
Well, and it's hitting in the later rounds, too, is one of the biggest things. Also, just talking about the Correa stuff, it was 2017, right, that the Cardinals were left without first-round picks, or their first two picks,
first
right,
two.
Because of the...
Right.
And I know that the draft is about, and we've seen the Cardinals over the past, you guys mentioned a couple examples already, of later rounds hitting on players. As far as percentages go, your first couple of rounds are generally the ones.
Yeah.
So when you look at the system right now, I mean, that's damning as well. Missing out on a couple of draft picks early on, that ends up killing you.
So I guess the only thing you can do at that level then is really invest internationally. And I think there are a lot of teams that do that better than others. And some have done it for a really long time because you're not really subject to the draft then. You know, I mean, if you really wanted to, you could invest at that level. And we talked about Luis Robert last year, or was it two years ago?
Everybody was in.
Yeah, I mean,
almost everybody.
But the Cardinals also said they weren't willing to commit that. That seemed like a lot of money. In the end, I believe it was $52 million they committed total, which, I mean, if he turns into a really nice player, that's not that much money. I mean, I understand not wanting to commit money. But if you're trying to set yourself apart from everybody else, you have to do something, and you got to take some risks.
And the other thing you have to do, and this goes back to evaluating your own guys, you can't have personal issues. I don't know if there were personal issues with Tommy Pham, but you can't have personal issues interfere with your evaluation of a player. And you have to pick the right guys to move. If you're going to move an Oscar Mercado, who seems to be a pretty valuable piece of property right now, then you have to get good pieces back in return. I don't know if Capel and the other guy they got back from Cleveland are going to be good, but you have to get good pieces back in return.
Yeah, it's nice to be on the other end of the fleece.
Yeah, and the Cardinals have been for years.
Yeah, and the Tommy Pham thing, certainly. I mean, Tommy would look great in this lineup, and who knows why a bunch of things are done. I don't necessarily think it would be a personal thing as far as a front office goes, and maybe it's a whole team thing where it's like, all right, we got to change directions here. We're going down a bad place. Look, Tommy played the game hard as can be. He continues to play the game really hard and thriving, so... It's recently the trades haven't looked to be the best. I do believe the Luke Voit one, while people are up in arms about that, look, yeah, it was a trade that you had to make, and you'll take Goldie over Voit for the long haul, I believe. And by the way, Giovanni Gallegos has been great for you.
Yeah, it's so easy to second guess, but there was nobody save for Luke Voit's family out in West County that complained about the Cardinals moving Luke Voit to the Yankees last year. Nobody.
No, I wasn't upset about it, and I really wasn't upset about Pham. If, however, it was because of personality issues or clashing or people didn't like him or like playing alongside him or a conflict with the front office, that would annoy me. If it's because you're trying to project long-term, you're thinking about his next contract, and if you're willing to give a guy who's got an eyesight problem that sort of money moving forward, that makes sense to me. But if it's because he butts heads with people in the organization, that to me, that would bother me, because I think he's too talented for that. But if it's because you don't think the guy's going to be able to see in a couple of years and he'll go back to the way he played, you know, about 3 years ago, then that makes total sense.
And he still has, after he's got 3.1 years of service time heading into this year. So you still have control of him if you're the Cardinals last year for 4 more years, right? You would have had 4 more years of service time left. So you don't worry about free agency. You worry more about the eyesight if you're going to worry about anything. It's the Fast Lane on 101 ESPN with Brad Thompson and Chris Ronji. I'm Randy Carricker. It's 3:13. Time check brought to you by Clarkson Jewelers, an officially licensed Rolex jeweler. And it looks like another strike is on the way in Major League Baseball. With that, what did we learn from 1994? And how would it be different this time around? That's next on 101 ESPN. But was that really the story, though? Randy Chastain getting the winner on the PK.
I think that it's probably in our best interest to say yes, it was.
Did something else happen?
But what's iconic about her scoring that goal?
Well, you know, just celebration.
Taking her kit off.
Well, not the whole kit.
No, just the top part of the kit.
Remember how mad people were?
They were outraged.
Yeah, her kit's
an outrage, I tell you. Yeah.
Said kids, right?
But yeah,
I had no problem.
Didn't say that. In 1994, we are looking back at the 90s today, flashback week on 101 ESPN. 1994, August 12th, there was a baseball strike that started and didn't end until well into spring training of 1995. Canceled the World Series, ruined a lot of teams, ended some careers, ended an historic season. And Bob Nightingale writes today at usatoday.com that a strike is on the way in Major League Baseball. What is it different now about a strike compared to the 90s? Well, players have more money, and they can stick it out more than they did in the 90s. They have an extraordinary amount of money. At that point, it's interesting, Major League Baseball offered a salary cap that included 50% of league revenues, and players turned it down out of hand. Players would love that now if they could get 50% of league revenue. And baseball was losing money, and I know that there's a lot of people that can't believe it, but the TV contracts weren't as good as they are now, and the attendance wasn't as good as it is now.
Yeah, there's a lot more cash out there, just overall, and it just goes back to you know, the players wanting what they believe to be a fair share. Now, I know that, I mean, Bob Nightingale's writing this piece. We've been talking about it forever. I don't believe that a strike is imminent. I don't believe that this is for sure going to happen. The CBA doesn't expire until December 31st of 2021. We have two more full seasons of conversation. We have two more full seasons, and then a couple of months before the season starts, of back and forth, of posturing, of... and I think that Major League Baseball, the Players Association, are doing a great job right now of not necessarily saying that they want to strike. Nobody's saying they want to strike, but they are proving that they're not afraid to do so. And when you're going up against bajillionaires, you kind of have to take that stance. They've been building a war chest for a long time. They've been urging their players to save their money. They've been, you know, upping dues. So they have plenty of cash if, in fact, they have to get to a situation where they have to help out some of their guys while they go through a strike. They're prepared. And I think that in any situation where you're heading towards a labor dispute or you just have a collective bargaining agreement coming up, you have to be prepared for it. Nobody wants to strike. Players don't want to strike. Owners don't want to strike. Certainly fans don't want to strike. But you have to be ready to do whatever you have to do.
And if you're the players, you better put that fear of God into the owners. You better say, look, we are willing to do this. So unless you're willing to come to the table and make something happen, this is a very real possibility. So I think the beginning of the posturing happening right now, and maybe it's happened before, you know, it probably started a little bit before this, but the fact you've got guys who are now very easily and willfully saying, look, we're together on this, and we are more than willing to go through a strike to get what we want. I mean, there are a lot of things have to happen here. Certainly, when we talk about, and Randy, you mentioned that the salary cap idea, which would have given them 50%, the only way that works and the only way the players agree to it is if you implement a salary floor, because there are a lot of teams that are just not willing to spend, and that's not acceptable. You also mentioned the attendance. They are on pace to have their worst attendance since 1996.
Right.
And that is also not a
which
very good
thing.
Which
was 2 years after that strike.
Right.
One of the things that I wonder about, if you are, and this is kind of off the beaten path, but if you... To me, if you're Tony Clark and you're responsible, this is something that you have to take into account. Does a ballpark village count as baseball revenue? Does what the Cubs have done what they built around Wrigley Field, which is directly attributable to the fact that people are going to baseball games, does that count as baseball revenue? I think it's going to be really hard to figure out what baseball revenue is at this point.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a great question. It's certainly something that the players' union is going to say yes, ownership will say no, and who knows if it falls in the middle of those two. But yeah, it's a very difficult one, I guess, to draw a hard line on, because, I mean, technically, not really, but all the money comes because of it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, the bottom line here is
ownership. It is called Ballpark Village.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't know how much money they are getting specifically from that or what the Cubs are going to get, because I don't think they're done building actually around Wrigley Field. All I know is they have built a ton, and there's a lot of revenue coming in. baseball owners have money, and they've got more money to spend, I believe, across the board than they let on, which is really the issue here, because you're going to get people, and I'm sure if I looked at the text line right now, it's going to be a concoction of people.
Greedy
players are greedy. Hey, man, why does nobody look at – yes, and Randy mentioned it earlier. Players make a lot of money. Why does nobody look at how much –
we spend a lot of money.
That's true.
Yes,
think about that.
That's true, but ownership makes way, way more.
Players are rich. Owners are wealthy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Wealthy is like you don't have to worry about anything ever. And I understand players probably – a lot of them don't either.
Probably not. But it's a different level. It's a whole different ballgame.
Exactly. It's different than what we are doing and what the average person does. There's an understanding there. But the point is, the players are the product, and they're the ones who bring in the revenue. And yes, I know ownership takes risks. I get that. But the players are what sell tickets. The players are what make money. And they deserve, I think anyway, half of what comes in.
Well, and for a first time in this upcoming CBA, or at least it's in the forefront for a first time, the players' union is going to be looking for something a little bit different. And it's talked about in the piece that Nightingale did. But basically, I mean, currently in the CBA, we've had players under control for a long time, paying players very little money under the controllable years, but then paying you for your career beforehand on the back end.
Right.
And it all kind of came out in the wash. Yeah. Well, now you don't have that structure anymore. So the difference in this CBA is going to be one of the focuses will be getting to pay players for their prime. Getting to that bite of the apple or whatever term you want to use, getting to it earlier. The problem is ownership's not going to want to relinquish that. They're not going to want to pay more for guys that they have, quote-unquote, under control right now. But when you're the players' union, you think about this, you put in all this work, and let's say a guy is fortunate, okay, to get to the big leagues at 23 or 24 years old.
A guy is fortunate to get to the big leagues at 23 or 24 years old.
Excellent, gentlemen. It'll be 6 years that they are under team control right now. Now they're at 30. And they're on the wrong side of it. And then they're set up. They want their big payday. And teams are like, our numbers can actually say we'll give you a two-year deal. We'll give you, fair market value for those couple of years, but that's all you're going to get. Well, it's not good enough. It's not good enough for the players' union. It's not good enough for the players. And something has to change. So that's why they're getting ready for this. Understand, players don't want it. Nobody wants to do this.
And my question about this is going to be, because in every negotiation, there is a give and take. Gave up so much. Tony Clark gave up so much in the last negotiation. What do the players have to give in return for what they want?
Stopping play. I think that's really the only thing they can do.
But ultimately,
what can they concede otherwise?
The owners are they're going to want something out of this contract. It's not just because they are in a bad spot. They're going to want something out of this contract. I don't know if it's going to be taking away the chef. I don't know.
What do you mean no more chef?
Not having to pay clubhouse dues anymore?
Yeah. So it's what the players gave up, what Tony Clark gave up on behalf of the players to the owners in the last CBA is criminal. I don't know if the players can get that back in one fell swoop.
It's almost like sometimes it happens a lot of times, when agents, they negotiate deals for their players. And what they'll do is they'll say, look at all the little benefits I got you. You get a suite on the road. Every time you leave town, you get to stay in a suite in the hotel instead of a regular room like everybody else. Yeah, but you're not signed for a whole lot of money. They seem to forget the biggest part of the whole negotiation process. They get these little side benefits. You get a chef. The clubhouse dues aren't the same anymore. It sounds nice, but it's not the meat.
And I'm going to say something with all due respect. If I'm a Cardinal player, I'm saying, Jed Jerko's got a suite on the road.
Does he have that in his contract?
He does.
That's awesome.
And next year when he's gone, Carlos Martinez gets one starting in 2020.
All right. It's a good gig if you can get it.
It is.
I used to go hang out with all the guys that had suites in their room. Smart. Kyle Loesch had that in his contract. Wow. We used to run video games out of that place, and it was fantastic.
I'll bet. That's pretty cool.
Got to host parties if you have a suite.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, party in my room. Suite.
Are video games allowed on the road? Do the Cardinals allow it?
I would hope so. It's a good way to keep your players in.
Who doesn't? Isn't it
Boston?
There was
an NHL team that said no.
That's right.
Forget who it was.
Well, because
they banged Fortnite, though.
Yeah. That's right, because there was some prospect that was staying up until 6 in the morning playing video games, and he was too tired to practice.
So good piece by Bob Nightingale at USA Today about the prospects of a strike coming up in a couple of years in Major League Baseball. Next up, most of us were shocked to see Kevin Durant sign with the Nets, and apparently the team found out the same time all of us did. That's next in your Hot Topics of the Day on 101 ESPN. When you use that mic drop feature on the 101 ESPN app, you can pick from a lot of different things that might be your favorite sports moment of the 90s. And it doesn't have to be the St. Louis thing. There are a lot of great St. Louis things, though. Heck, when you think about it, in 1998-99, you had McGuire, who was the biggest thing in baseball. Mm-hmm. You had Chris Pronger, who was one of two people ever to win MVP in as a defenseman in the NHL, and you had the advent of Kurt Warner in 99. But you had Hulley at the beginning of the decade. You had the trade for Gretzky. You had the trade for McGuire. You had the Cardinals coming back to prominence with Tony La Russa being added in 96. You had the sale of the franchise from Anheuser-Busch to the DeWitt family. You had the arrival of the Rams in 1995, and, of course, their first season. A lot of cool stuff happened in the 90s. We want to hear what your favorite sports memory of the 90s is and why, and if you were there, you can describe it for us a little bit as well here on 101 ESPN. Use that 101 ESPN app with the mic drop feature. Okay, hot topics of the day. John Morosi of MLB Network reports that at least three teams have inquired into the Mets into the availability of Noah Syndergaard. Brewers, Astros, Padres all have inquired to the Mets, although the Mets aren't soliciting offers. I would hope that one other team, at least one other team, gets into that bidding.
Yeah, I would hope so, too. And I hope that team stays in the Central and it's not the Cubs or the Reds or the
Brewers.
It is the Brewers already.
Damn.
So, yeah, that would be nice. And that's the type of guy that we're talking about. As we've referenced many times, the Cardinals, at least in our belief, I don't know exactly what the organization believes, their need for a starting pitcher. They don't have a need for a back-end starting pitcher. They have a need for somebody that can go out there and shove. And Noah Syndergaard, even though he's had some health issues, when he's healthy, he is one of those guys. Like that's the type of guy you should be on the horn about.
And what about Zach Wheeler? Do we have any interest in him? I know the Boston Red Sox are interested in him.
I think we've got a Mets insider on later. We'll ask
him. We'll talk to him about that. I'm with you on the idea of getting a top-of-the-line guy because that is exactly what this team needs. But I'm almost at the point where any amount of help they can get in that regard, I'm willing to take it.
Would you make this offer? And I don't even know if this offer would be accepted. But I know you guys both like these players. Okay. And from a financial standpoint, it's a not our money thing for the Cardinals. Would you trade Alex Reyes, Jack Flaherty, and Paul DeJong for Francisco Lindor and Corey Kluber?
Yes.
Yes.
I would too.
Was that
right
too
now.
Quick?
No, I would too. I would too.
Yeah, guys. As soon as you said Francisco Lindor, so my first initial thought when you named off Flaherty, it was no. No, screw you, Randy. I'm not going to do it. But then you said Frankie Lindor.
Yep.
Wait. Lindor's contract, is it up after next year?
I think it's 3 years.
Oh, he's got a couple?
Two years left after this. And I think Kluber might have 2 years left for Kluber, too.
Cleveland would probably say, and what else?
Yeah, they
most likely,
they
but I would do that in a minute.
They also know that they aren't going to have those two guys.
Yeah.
I don't know, but they're going to... They're trying to win. They have to do right by Terry Francona and the group that they have this year.
I was going to say Kluber does have two more years. They're both club options at $17.5 and $18 million. You're hoping that he comes back.
And by the way, he's close to coming back, but not quite there yet. He's long tossing now. Kluber is
the line drive off of his arm, which was a little bit of a problem. And I'm looking up Francisco Lindor's contract currently, but. I'd be very interested in something like that. Did we just make a magical trade, though?
Yes, we did.
Yes.
You know what, though? But at least we did it with real players.
That would hurt to get rid of.
Big time.
All right, so Francisco Lindor is signed.
2 years of
arm? Yeah. Earliest free agency in 2022.
So, yeah.
Then
let's
lock
go.
His ass up,
let's
too.
Let's go.
Yeah.
I'll go pick him up.
Basketball Nets general manager Sean Marks told the New York Daily News that Kevin Durant didn't tell the team he was signing with them before he announced it on social media. He said, the Instagram post that he put up, we were all sitting in the office. We all got that in real time with you guys. We weren't even sure if he was getting a meeting that night or if it was going to be a telephone conversation with him. So he agreed to sign without an offer. Mark says, with those guys, they're at a different level. They know. I'm not going to sit here and tell them, well, we'd like to discuss a contract with you. We know what we're getting into. How about that? So he didn't even really need to talk to him. He just said, yeah, I'm going to Brooklyn, and they'll sign me.
Everybody's going to Brooklyn, apparently.
Yeah. You Brooklyn's know. Happening now.
I like Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's nice.
I mean, I like the idea of Brooklyn.
Estate. Yeah.
Never actually been there.
No. That is crazy.
I rode my bike through Brooklyn, and it was great.
Yeah, you did that big bike
tour thing.
You going to do that one again? How many bike rides do you have on the agenda here? I know you have the donut, Tour de Donuts.
Tour de Donuts coming up. There's the Tour de Brat coming up in Highland, Illinois, coming up later in the summer. I want to do one in Nashville, and the next year I want to do one in D.C. too. They're pretty much everywhere in the country, they close down roads on a Sunday morning, except for St. Louis, to do a bike ride. We do the Moonlight Ramble, but I'm going to be out of town for the Moonlight Ramble.
Do we still do that?
Yeah, we're bringing it back this year.
Good.
Yeah, August 16th, I think.
Nice.
Yeah, but I'm going to be out of town. 17th, I guess. Saturday night, 16th into the 17th, which is awesome. I love the Ramble, but I'm not going to be here for it.
And that was an all five boroughs bike ride, right?
Yeah, the five borough tour.
How long did that take?
About 3 hours, 40 miles.
That's actually not bad at all.
No, you ever ridden a borough?
Great day. I have not.
Like a donkey?
On an actual burrow?
Oh, I've never ridden on a burrow. I've ridden through a burrow.
Yeah.
Not a burrow, but
I feel like a burrow five burrow thing would be really cool.
That would take 5 days.
It would take a while, yeah.
Yeah. Aren't those the things that will take you down into the Grand Canyon?
Yeah. Yeah. Jackasses.
Oh, so does a hover on, though.
No, it takes you to the edge. Yeah. It's different.
Then he did a 360, and we just all kind of hope that he'd
fall
over.
Hover takes you where you want to go, over the edge of the Grand Canyon.
Just kind of wish he had a small malfunction, just for playing with technology like that. I believe that technology is, there's robots in there.
Oh, okay. What if that's the only way you have to get to the edge of the Grand Canyon?
Hover
is the hover around.
I'm there.
I mean, you got to do what you got
to
do.
Yeah. He didn't have to do a 360.
Well, now he's showing off.
He's just spinning on the edge. Look at this thing.
If you don't know, just go to YouTube and do hover around Grand Canyon commercial they've got. It's tremendous.
The turn radius on those things.
Oh, it's like a zero-turn lawnmower.
It's unbelievable.
It's phenomenal. And one other basketball note, Kawhi Leonard has signed a three-year deal with the Clippers rather than a long-term deal. 2 years plus a player option, and LeBron James has 2 years left, too. So we might be in 2 years right where we are today. Paul George has 2 years left. We might have the same kind of free agency in 2 years that we're dealing with today in the NBA. That's fine, though. I'm good with that.
It took over. Free agents, they don't play games for a few more months.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped watching baseball games because of NBA free agency. Like, people weren't tuned in. They got it going on over in the NBA.
It would be fun in baseball if they had the floor and the ceiling so that and the free agency period started and all the teams got to get their stuff together and they have to worry about other teams trying to sign and take the guys they want and there's not this 5 month drawn out process of who's going to go where.
Day one, it's bang, here we go. I this guy signing there. This guy makes an Instagram post, and now he's in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Like, remember how boring the winter meetings were this year?
Oh, the worst.
Like, terrible.
Oh, they signed a reliever, and we're just.
And now, if you do that, if you know ahead of time what your team's going to look like, you can spend the next several months talking about the season coming up and how things are going to look. I would love it if baseball were more like that.
And our final hot topic of the day. Adoring fans lined New York City's Canyon of Heroes today to praise the World Cup winning U.S. Women's National Soccer Team as athletic leaders on the field and as advocates for pay equity off of it. Construction workers sounded air horns above the crowds chanting USA, USA as the hour-long ticker tape parade moved up a stretch of Lower Broadway that has long hosted such celebrations for world leaders, veterans, and hometown sports stars. So there you have it.
Nice.
Parades are fun.
I love a parade. You know,
I
we
like watching them better than being like in them.
Yeah.
Well, not in them.
No,
like if you want
to be.
But
in.
I'm saying like I like watching from an elevated, like on TV,
or like a bus.
Bus
or
great.
A float because
that's
you're in
fun.
It.
Yeah, that's fun.
Those are your hot topics of the day on 101 ESPN. Once again, the mic drop feature later on. We want to hear from you, your favorite sports memory of the 1990s. Coming up next, in the 1990s, the Blues were all about star power. Then Mike Keenan showed up. That's next on 101 ESPN. Ken Wilson had the call, and it was the first of many for Wayne Gretzky with the St. Louis Blues. They traded for him in February of 1996. And on that team, in addition to Gretzky, They had Al MacInnis and Chris Pronger, both in the Hall of Fame. They have Brett Hull, and their goalie was Grant Fuhr. They could put a group of six players on the ice, five of them being future Hall of Famers.
It's not
amazing.
Sad anymore, though, right?
No.
Like, it was sad for a really long time. It's like, how did they not win a Stanley Cup? We're cursed. It's not sad anymore. Hey, Randy, when that trade was made, when they were able to bring Gretzky over, what was this place like? Like, how crazy was the fan base when that happened?
It was kind of like winning the Stanley Cup.
That's the best ever.
The loudest that until these playoffs that that building had ever been. And the Blues had star power, and we knew the players wanted to come to St. Louis. But like Wayne Gretzky said, I always like playing in blue. I think I look good in blue. And for them to pull that deal off and be able to bring him here, because they really didn't give up that much. Roman Vopat was one of the guys they gave up. They gave up a first-round draft choice. Vopat was a really high-level prospect at that time. But as it turns out, nothing that the Kings got out of it was really worthwhile. Craig Johnson, Patrice Tardif, Roman Vopat, a fifth-round choice and a first-round choice, and none of that wound up being very good. But, yeah, you bring in the greatest player in the history of the game, and you put him with Brett Hull, and you're thinking, man, this is unstoppable. And unfortunately, that chemistry between those two never really developed.
And also, it was that time. It was before the time where we are so conscious of how old a player is. And if you're going to trade for another guy, nowadays it's like, well, he's 35. He's 36 mm-hmm. years old. You can't go get that guy now. He's too old. He's at the end of his career. Back then, I feel like we didn't care about that stuff. It's like, oh, we got Wayne Gretzky. He's coming to play here. Who cares that he's going to probably only have a few more years left in him?
By the way, he was a 102-point guy that year.
Yeah, he was he was good.
Yeah.
And he was still good after the fact. I feel like if that trade were to happen now, that's the conversation that might dominate. It's, yeah, we got him, but look how old he is, and he's not going to be any good when we finally mm-hmm. get him. Don't you feel like that's sort of how we look at things now? We're more skeptical
and more
analytical about making those trades nowadays.
Yeah, but you think about the star power that the Blues had, in addition to Brett Hull, who still holds the all-time record and probably will always hold the all-time single-season record for goals by a winger with 86. But Adam Oates is a Hall of Famer. They traded him. Brendan Shanahan was here, Hall of Famer. They had to give up Shanny. They wound up trading him. Scott Stevens is a Hall of Famer. They lost him in an arbitration case. They never won the Stanley Cup, but there was nobody that had more star players and, at one point, star coaches than the Blues in that decade. And obviously the star coach was Mike Keenan. And we had Curtis Joseph on the show a few months back to talk about the experience of playing for Keenan here in St. Louis.
Mike came in here after winning a Stanley Cup in New York, and he was giving the general manager and coach, so he had a lot of control, and he exercised the control, to say the least, and, calling guys up from Worcester, Massachusetts, in the morning, and then after the skate, sending them back, playing head games with certain players and people, and trading all my friends away, and it was a little disheartening, but he had a plan, I guess, in his mind, and that's one thing I learned as a player, just be a player, and not, it's hard not to worry about what your friends are, where they're going, and guys getting traded, but it's pretty much out of your control, and it's hard not to get emotionally involved, but yeah, Mike had ultimate control, and he was trading me for sure.
Because he was one of the stars, and that's what Keenan didn't want around. And there is I don't know if it's myth or if it's true, but it has been mentioned that one time Keenan walked into the Blues locker room with Shanahan, Hull, and Joseph there and said, "I'm so tired of all your nicknames, Hully and Cujo and Shanny. I'm going to get rid of all of you." And the only one he didn't get rid of is Hull, who was gone a year after Keenan was as a free agent.
It's like, but it's hockey. This is what we do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Easy, Keenzy.
It's awesome.
Calm down. It's so funny hearing Cujo right there. And I remember while we were sitting there with him, his facial expressions as he's saying, that's about the nicest possible way he could have said those things. But you hear, oh, yeah, he exercised that control, mm-hmm. like just flexing the power. And he had a plan. I guess, in his mind.
Yeah.
Like it's crazy to have a cast of characters like you do on a team and have as talented of a group, but then have somebody that might be borderline crazy running them. That's a tough situation to have.
It's a pretty incredible turnaround, I think, is incredible that he was so sought after. We were so excited about bringing him in and how quickly that soured. It doesn't usually go that poorly that fast.
The Blues also, after Keenan left, were able to hire Joel Quenneville, who did a great job. And 99-2000, that season that started in 99, they won the President's Trophy. So even after Keenan, they were able to turn things around pretty quickly. A lot of the players that Keenan had brought in were key components of the Blues' success in that team. And once again, they had stars. They had people like Pavel Dimitra. Pierre Turgeon was one of the guys that the Blues brought in under Keenan, and he was here. Pronger obviously came in the Shanahan trade, and he won the MVP in that year. So it was a year, even though we didn't experience an awful lot of success as fans watching them, they didn't go to a conference final during the course of the decade. There may not have been a team outside of the Oilers of the 80s that had more Hall of Famers run their way through town.
It's pretty incredible when we talk about the Blues winning it this year. And there are a lot of really good players on this team. There's no question about that. But this is, and Randy, it was you that said it maybe right before and certainly after. Never would have thought this team, of all the teams, never would have thought this would have been the one to actually do it. Those mid-90s teams were so good, and that one in particular, the 96, that one, so much fun to watch. And I thought for sure, I mean, at the time, you're like, this has to happen. I mean, this is the team to do it.
And most logical observers think that if Fuhr doesn't get hurt, they probably win that year. And Ken Hitchcock told us when he was coach of the Blues, he said, in 1999, when the Stars won the Stanley Cup, if the Blues would have had
Hull.
Eddie Belfour. No, Hull. And the Stars would have had, I think Grant Fuhr was the Blues goalie that year, that the Blues would have won the Stanley Cup. It was a diminished Fuhr because of the knee injury. It was never the same. But he said if we would have had their goalie and they would have had ours, they would have won the Stanley Cup and they would have beaten us in the playoffs.
20 years later, you got your guy.
We got our guy.
You found the right guy in there.
Yeah. So it was a wild and woolly decade. Heck, they went through three different ownership groups in the decade.
Is that
lots
all?
Of coaches. Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's hard to have a lot of success like that. Continuity is important, I believe.
Continuity is a good thing to have, no doubt about it. It's the Fast Lane on 101 ESPN Flashback Week, and we want to hear from you with your favorite sports memory of the 1990s. But coming up, Brad is back after a win yesterday.
I was here all day yesterday.
Oh, yeah, but this is
Brad.
This is the third Brad.
Not that one either. He has a lot of
this
Brads.
This is a new Brad who's going to go for a win in day two of the 4 o'clock fight that's not about sports necessarily on 101 ESPN.